And welcome to Weather and Ag in Focus on this Friday Eve, 1:06 in the afternoon. I'm Chief Meteorologist Dean Wysocki, alongside with our wonderful, talented Ag Director, Bridget Riedel. Good afternoon, Bridget. How's your day going so far?
Going well. Hey, it must be more like fall. You have flannel on today.
I look like Paul Bunyan, except about the 5-foot version of him. So,
if you brought an axe to work, people are going to have greater questions than just that.
Well, they all know I have an axe to grind, so I don't need to bring an axe to work.
That's
really.
Right. That's right. There you go.
A lot of clouds, a lot of fog in the area, still continuing to hang on, especially west of the valley. But temperatures, again, above normal for this time of the year. It's we haven't had a stretch of more than 2 days, can you believe it, since October. We might have had a 3-day stretch. I'll have to check my calendar in the weather office, but I don't think we've had a stretch more than 2 days of below normal temperatures. Just an incredible, just mild okay. start. Mild start to fall. But there's always a but. There are changes coming, it looks like, as we're starting to see the signs of a complete flip in the atmosphere where we're going to start seeing the Arctic open up. Now, it's not going to be all of a sudden, but it looks like a gradual turn to colder air as we head towards at least part of next week. It's questionable whether it sticks around, but behind that, by the end of the month, I do believe we'll have some true cold air coming in here. It looks like probably Thanksgiving weekend, if not a little bit sooner than that. So hopefully that does not impede on any Thanksgiving travel. I know a lot of people hit the roads during Thanksgiving weekend, and boy, it looks cold that weekend. That could change, but that's the way it's really starting to trend.
Cold weather's not a big deal, though. It's what you bring with it for precipitation.
Exactly.
That's the concern.
Right. And usually they go, usually before we get that big cold dump of air, we usually typically will get a strong storm system prior to that that allows that cold air to dump in. Now, we do have one of those coming in next week, and we'll see a brief punch of cold air after that. But some much needed moisture, and I'm talking widespread throughout the area. This is probably some of the best news I've seen come our way
in a while.
In the last month and a half, seriously. Now it's unfortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to hit the areas that need it the most, which is the far western part of the state. Doesn't mean they're going to get totally missed out, but it doesn't look like they'll see nearly as much as we do here in the eastern third of the state and into Minnesota. And again, this track could change. The main storm track so far this year or this fall has been to our south. Now, could this stay to our south? It sure could. It wouldn't shock me if new model runs come in over the weekend where this thing stays to our south. But right now, all models are in pretty good agreement that this thing comes north and we see some widespread rain by Tuesday of next week. And we'll detail a little bit of that more at the towards the end of the show.
Okay, excellent. Well, one of the things that I forgot to mention yesterday was the names of those who have won rain gauges and a grain gauge from us with our Here We Grow project with our yield contest. We wanted folks to give us their guesses. Mm-hmm. How many bushels of corn did you think we were going to raise? And we came in at 194 bushels of corn. We actually beat the field average. Felt like we had a pretty good crop out there. Like everybody else, we'd probably take another buck on corn right now. So feel free to pay us a little bit more, whoever's listening. But nonetheless, it allowed us to give our donation to Farm Rescue for all the good work that they do across, again, 9 states, nearing 1,200 families that they've been able to help. So we gave them our donation of $1,000 yesterday, but to Jeff and to Clyde, who both came in at 192 bushels of corn, so they got the closest without going over, I have rain gauges for you at the front desk at our studio. Stop by anywhere before 5 o'clock on a business day to pick them up. And then our grain gauge, which was donated by IntelliFarms from Castleton, North Dakota, that is going to go to a listener, Chris. And I know who Chris is. I know he lives in northern Minnesota, so I'm just going to make sure to hand it off at a trade show one of these days. So it's been great fun to do this project. All of our videos are up for you to watch. They are on our Facebook page. They are on YouTube. And just like when you watch us every day, you can catch us there as well as Acres TV. And don't forget to call with those questions on the Red Wing Shoe Line, 701-293-9000. So there, all the housekeeping taken care of for the day, Dean.
Are you sure? We got it all in.
Oof, I hope so. I didn't want to leave out our winners. I mean, they went through the effort of sending us their guesses. I wanted to make sure to give them good recognition.
And what did, before Justin bailed on us and quit, what did he have? Didn't he have 200?
I think he was at 225,
but
he's probably listening and will text us his response. But he was a little bit higher. Here's the thing, though. Justin Storm, as one of our teammates through the majority of this project, does a fabulous job of setting a goal that's high, raising that bar. So all we have to do is get there. And we tried.
We came close. We came close.
Yeah, we weren't quite there.
Well, and the one video that you shot, which I think you said was one of the best ones that you got, both you and Justin did, with the seed and doing the pep talk.
If you haven't watched these, we were trying to coach our corn seed up to hit that goal. And we had our bags of seeds sitting in chairs in an office with their little Dairyland seed caps on. And I was coaching them up about what they were going to do for yield. And Justin came in and blew the whistle and said, "Hustle up. I got money riding on this." So it was a lot of fun to do those. And we did a lot of learning moments from the days that we spray painted the corn to see how much growth we were going to get in a 24-hour period, to the days that we were talking about farm safety. We also were in the field when we checked the field for nitrogen deficiencies, and then all the way out until we got to harvest when we combined it and took it back to the bin. So check those out. They were a good series of videos.
And if anybody wants to watch those videos, Bridget?
Facebook and YouTube under Weather and Ag in Focus. You can find us there.
Perfect. Perfect. And there's some funny videos on there too. So you get
we do a lot of things that bring humor.
A little amusement in there for sure. Well, we've got a special guest coming on today. I know we kind of were talking about this a little bit yesterday, but explain who's coming on with us, because this sounds really interesting.
Okay, now shoot, I'm sitting too far away to go grab my actual copy of the book, but Lee Clancher, and I have to make sure I'm saying Lee's last name right, and I met at the Farm Progress Show in Iowa back in August, and he was there with Case IH talking about a number of book lines that they have. But Lee is an author who writes specifically about farm equipment, and he just released a book in time for Christmas. It's called Snoopy and the Spy. And for those in the region who remember the IH tractors that had the very long front nose, they were articulating, they articulated in the middle. I've had farmers say, "Oh, but the frame always broke on that tractor." It was good horsepower. And it was sort of during the time frame, not sort of, but it was during the time frame that there was a lot of pressure for more horsepower, bigger tractors. John Deere was coming out with front wheel drives. And so this book is about Case IH and some tractor espionage. So it's called Snoopy and the Spy. And I'm very much looking forward to talking to Lee and kind of his history in farm equipment, but then also the pre-epitus to this book, what brought it around. So
tractor
espionage. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting.
It's pretty cool.
Cool.
So I'm going to get this picture sent over to Addison so we can get this in our live stream for today, because that way people can see what the book looks like and be ready to place their orders, just like I did to get your copy.
Perfect. Perfect. And we'll have more with Lee. First, we've got to we'll take a quick break here with the American Ag Network. And then when we come back, we'll be talking with Lee about his book and his background as well. If you have any questions for us or for our guest when he comes on the air, be sure to give us a call, 701-293-9000. That's on the Red Wing Shoe line. Again, that's 701-293-9000. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to Weather and Ag in Focus. Thanks for joining us. So glad that you're here today, because I've really been waiting to talk to this guest ever since I had a chance to meet Lee at Farm Progress in Iowa this summer. And so joining us today is Lee Clancher. And Lee, did I say that right? I never did ask you in the advance.
you're close. It's Clancher, like the A's and O, but it's fine. You're
in the ballpark. Okay. Lee, why do you write books about farm equipment?
Oh my, that's a short answer, right? I was a science writer way back in college, and I got recruited to do a book about farm tractors. And I love machines. I love the country. I love history. I like photographing outside. And I just found it was a fit. And the thing that I've really come to that I really love about this topic is farm machinery changed so much of our world, had a huge effect. You know, if all of us were spending our time gathering food, we wouldn't have the world that we live in today. So I like to think of the history of farm equipment as really the history of our society and how it evolved.
Lee, what do you think is the biggest change you've seen, let's say over the last, we'll say 40, 50 years in terms of farm equipment? I mean, there's so many of them, but what do you think is the biggest one or the most important change that we've seen?
Wow, that's a hard question for me. I might want time and write an essay and come back to you. You know, I would say the one that's looming is automation. The challenge, the really interesting thing is, as a historian, if you go back to 1914 to today, the problems are very similar in a very broad level, right? People are leaving the farm. Farmers have to produce more and do it with less people. And they have to produce more to survive financially, and people just, there's less and there's less and there's less. And that's just how it's been. So, you know, when I look at that problem and I'm like, all right, as you look through history, you know, all these different generations of farmers have dealt with that and tried to figure that out. The answer, of course, has been big machines that are more efficient. Automation, which, you know, in particularly in combines, is just amazing technology these days. I think that's something that has allowed, okay, you can put one guy in that giant combine and he can get a lot done, or she. So that's the one I'd pick. But like I said, I'd love to have, you know, a year to research it and give you a really thoughtful answer.
There's so many things that you have researched, though, Lee. And when I look at the list of them, so one of the things that I learned, and I'd like to think as a farm kid growing up, I should have known this, but realistically, IH, International Harvester, was the leading tractor company, and John Deere was all about implements, tillage tools, etc. When did that shift that John Deere really started to make the leap ahead in tractor technology?
That's a great point. And IH was this big dominant machine, and Deere, especially when IH merged back in 1902, and for the next 30, 40 years, Deere just had to be very, very smart to survive, because IH was so big. They owned 85% of the market when they formed. So for a while there, they were just surviving. And they did so with, it's a great story. I mean, they were just really consistent, really smart, really careful. And that's carried through. I think that company carries that mark of being careful with innovation and things today. But in the 50s, I believe it was 1955, Bill Hewitt became the CEO. And by that time, they were in spitting distance. No longer was there the big gap. They were close. They were number two, but they weren't far off. And Mr. Hewitt decided, we're going to be number one. And IH had been sitting on their laurels since about 1945, 1939, whatever you want. They came out with this very innovative series in 39, and they just didn't innovate the way they should have in tractors. They tried to broaden their company by going into other markets. So there was an opportunity, and Hewitt was incredibly aggressive. He put a bunch of people in a butcher shop in Iowa, a bunch of engineers, and said, we need, if you remember, they had two-cylinder tractors. Their engines had two cylinders. And that was a, you know, company ethic. Going away from that was a very big deal. So he said, you develop a line of 4 and 6 cylinder engines and a brand new line of tractors and do it in total secrecy. This butcher shop, the windows were blocked out. No one was allowed in. And in 1960, they introduced those. And in 63, they took over the number one position and they never looked back.
That's a huge step forward. And I love what you said about they were in this butcher shop with the blacked out windows. This was truly secretive work. And we wouldn't necessarily think of that today, but they didn't have a secure place to go where everybody didn't see it and then take it to the coffee shop where the engineers from the other company were all sitting around too, right?
Well, and that's with Snoopy, a lot of this espionage is so fun because, and the reason is these companies lived very closely. The combine plants at one point were almost back to back. They were so close in Moline. So they could very easily figure out what the other guys were doing. And because that industry, these development cycles are very long. So you don't develop an all new farm technology in a year. It's, you know, it's 3, it's 5, it's 10. In the case of the axial flow combine, it's 25 years. So if you think about that, so you have these long cycles, that means if the other people figure out what you're doing and you're 3 to 5 or 8 years up, they can just jump on the bandwagon and you lose your edge. So there was a lot of secrecy around the axial flow. Was also developed in a building with blacked out windows. And I was told for like a decade, like 10 people had keys to that building. They were okay. Just maniacal about keeping it a secret what they were doing.
Speaking of the axial flow combines, those weren't mainstream until probably the 80s. But correct me if I'm wrong, you've written about that technology that was being developed in the 50s. I mean, it's much older than we anticipate, right?
Much older. And the idea came up much earlier. I think it was 1800s. There was a guy named Curtis Baldwin in the 30s who actually spent his whole life trying to develop that technology. It's very difficult to get it to work. They get a spinning rotor to separate grain is one of those things that's an idea that makes sense, but doing it is incredibly difficult. Baldwin died. He never got it to work. So it had been known John Deere and IH tried it in the 50s and both failed. And it just happened that there was a group of engineers from IH who were not in Chicago. They were down in Mount Joy. And in Mount Joy, they were far enough away from the corporate eyes that they could fiddle around with what they wanted. They loved this technology and they worked on it. There was a Swedish engineer named Elof Karlsson. He worked on it from 1955 until the mid 60s. And when Deere took number one, all of a sudden the IH management is like, look, we're in trouble. What the hell? We got to do something. And then it came up, well, we've been working with this. Maybe we could develop that. And it then became on the books and something that was a priority. But it took another 10 years, even with all the work that had been done, to make that technology work. So some of these things are just incredibly difficult engineering challenges.
Wow, that's pretty wild. Hey, Lee, we got one of our listeners emailed a question in wanting to know what would be your favorite tractor model or make and why?
All right. My favorite, it would be Steiger, and it would be the barn built Steigers, because that is such a miracle. Steiger, you know, three guys in a barn build a tractor so that they have something big enough to use in their fields. And they build that to be a global brand that lives today. That's a once in a millennia type of story. So anything like that where somebody, you know, put the effort in and built it themselves, wow, I'm just blown away.
Oh, I'm so excited you said Steiger. They're from right up here.
I could hear Bridget's excitement all the way over here.
I was so hoping we were going to get to talk about Steiger today, too.
Oh, God. Bridget, I will send you. We have a book, Red Four-Wheel Drive Tractors, that has the whole story. But Steiger has so many wonderful moments. My favorite thing about it, when we did that book, people from Steiger just love to come out and talk about it. It's smaller than IH. It was a little easier story to get your head around. But they had so many crazy moments where they really should have went under. I mean, that industry is so hard. It's so expensive to develop anything. And if you develop something and then you get one of the inevitable farm busts, you're done. You're out of money.
Yes.
They had, there's so many moments. The one I love the most, when they moved to Fargo, they really were trying to step up. And Douglas was backing out of the company, Douglas Steiger, a little bit. And they hired this guy from a Minneapolis ag company as their CEO. And I can't remember his name. But it turned out, the guys told me that this guy, they literally thought this guy might be a vampire because he would work all night and sleep all day. And this was their big magic CEO, you know? He did not.
Oh, gosh. Okay, there's going to be so many more great stories. I even have one from Doug Steiger's daughter, Margina. She has been on the show with us, and I've got one to relay for you as well, Lee. But when we come back from bottom of the hour news, I have a listener comment. We have a ton of questions because we've got to get to talking about your most recent book, Snoopy and the Spy. So, Addison, you can put that picture up of what it looks like. Folks, go check this out on our live stream if you're interested. You can make sure that you're ordering this just in time for Christmas now. But it's a great read, not a long book. I loved it. Read it on a Sunday afternoon. So we'll talk about Snoopy and the Spy when we return. Thanks for joining myself and our chief meteorologist, Dean Wysocki, today. We're thrilled that you're here, and especially to hear our guest, Lee Clauncher. Lee is a historian for tractors. And you know, as someone who spent the majority of her career killing weeds and getting rid of bugs from fields, I get so much more excited about farm equipment now than I ever did with things like Steiger and just talking about those older series tractors. Everybody had the 4010s, the 4020s. I grew up with, you know, a 706 on the farm. Lee, you have written all these fantastic books, and the most recent one is called Snoopy and the Spy. So let's start out with, what's the Snoopy tractor? What was going on with that machine in the 70s?
Well, so the Snoopy tractor is sort of the star of this. And the Snoopy tractor is the IH2+2. And to back up a step, where this book came from was, I've done all these big, thorough histories of farm machine history, farm all century, red tractors. And this one, I wanted to be something different. I wanted to be a little broader market book. And I wanted it to be just a really exciting, interesting narrative. So what I looked at was, what in all this work I've been working, 20 years, however you want to cut it, I've been doing this a long time. What is the time and story that's really interesting? And the time from 75 to 82, we touched on this before, right? Deere takes over the number one slot, IH is number two. IH kind of got their stuff together by 69-70, had pretty good new management in place, and was trying to get back to number one. Deere, in the meantime, was determined to hold on to number one. And they were just like doing things nobody had done in terms of research and development spending to make sure they stayed on top. Harvester, as the 70s wore on, was not just fighting to try to get back into number one. They were fighting to survive. And in this very volatile, exciting technological time, you have the farm crisis hit beginning really in the early 80s, kind of marked by the grain embargo in 79. So that time period is just fascinating. There's so much going on. And then we had stories from a man named Bud Yule. Bud Yule was an International Harvester salesperson. And a very colorful man, very colorful speaker, former Marine who approached everything like he was charging a hill and he was the last man that was going to take
it. Yes.
Wonderfully quotable, you know, from reading the book, and quite a character. And he had talked to us for these other books. We had interviewed him multiple times. We had, I think, 6 hours of tape of him talking about the things that happened to him. And then he had spoken at a lot of these tractor events, Red Power Roundups, and those guys were great. They recorded them. So we had this vast archive of things, of first-person stories that we could use. And the backdrop is all the other crazy things that are happening. So when you read this book, you're going to be immersed in kind of 78 to 82 and in kind of day-to-day events that are happening in this battle between Deere and IH and the other makers as well.
Oh, man. There was so much going on in that time frame because tractors were making leaps and bounds in horsepower and technology. This was about the same time that, okay, so the 2+2 came out and John Deere was working to bring out front wheel drives, right? This was like the first start of that era of tractors.
They were getting them to work. So they'd had, and it was becoming a popular thing because everything was about horsepower and traction. I mean, the thing we talked about, less people, more ground, meaning you need more power and the implements are bigger, so you need more traction. So four-wheel drives are becoming a big deal. The mechanical and or hydraulic, either one, front assist tractors, which is like a row crop tractor with the, you know, lugged front wheels and a drive in the front were terrible in the 60s and the 70s and really kind of into the 80s. So Deere is being Deere, meaning they're getting it right. And the series you're talking about, the 50 series of Deere, had a much, much improved front wheel drive system. And that's what prompted Bud Yule to sneak into a Deere convention, which is where the book kind of begins.
It does. So I have a listener question for you, but before I get to that, that 2+2, the reason it stands out for me is I grew up on a farm that was primarily green. We were very John Deere. But there was a time that when I was in elementary school, I think the local Case dealer was trying, or IH dealer was trying to get my dad's attention. We had a demo of the 2+2s on our farm. And I will never forget being mad as hell, having to get on the school bus, but my brother and sister were too young. They weren't in school yet. So they got to stay home and ride in all these tractors with all these people around and have the church ladies bring lunch out. But I had to go to school that day. So there are, and there are pictures of those tractors in our yard and in the photo albums at home. And it's just a memory that of why this tractor stands out for me.
Well, and the 2+2 now, was a very clever use. IH used two from their 86 series tractors, two rear ends, mated them, made it hinge, and with the new leadership had them actually think about doing market research, which they hadn't done very well in the past. And that showed there was a gap in this kind of 150 horsepower, four-wheel drive, row crop machine. And that's what it was. So they didn't have to develop too much because they used some existing parts, and it was very innovative. It really helped IH. It was funny looking. As you might recall, Bud Yule, who when he was shown it and they were telling him he has to sell it, he said, "That's the ugliest thing God ever made." So
he really did. Okay. Some listener questions. One of them is, who spent more money on their R&D, Case or at the time it was IH? Or John Deere?
Deere, as far as the records go, every year Deere did. Every year. Mm-hmm. Now, IH upped it quite a bit and was getting very close by, I think it's 81. And there are quotes where Arch McArdle, the much maligned leader, short-term leader of IH, said that they were going to spend, he quoted a number that would have been more than Deere for 82. But when the 82 annual report came out, that line wasn't in there. They usually say how much they spent in research and development. They didn't in 82. In 82, they were about to fail. They were losing money so badly. So they probably didn't want to be able. So pretty much Deere outspent them, despite all the effort IH put in. Deere was just, I mean, they were putting a larger proportion of their annual revenue and a larger number into R&D. They just spent. It's crazy.
Well, and wow. Lee, I mean, you've seen everything, like I said, come from so far in terms of technology. What do you see happening over the next 20 years in advancement that's going to help our ag community?
Whew. Again, automation, but we're getting, you know, that's really happening. There's a lot of talk. One of the things that's really interesting to me, there's a lot of talk about, well, and I don't know if it'll happen. If you had a fully automated tractor, which a lot of people are very resistant to.
Why is that?
I don't know. There might be the idea that a human is being replaced by a machine. That's probably the fundamental of it, but it's not something that the ag world has embraced. Case IH put one out a few years back, 2017 or 18. They had one as a demo at Farm Progress, and the reaction to it was extremely mixed. At that time, if you go fully automated, they don't have to be so big. You can have a bunch of little ones, because big is important, because you know your driver is going to wear out and need to go to sleep, and often there just isn't, you know, there's not a lot of labor on a farm. So you got to have these huge, huge machines. Well, if they're automated, let them run all night. Let them run all week. Who cares? And then you can have smaller machines, smaller implements. So that's a fascinating thing to me. We're going to keep seeing bigger, more powerful, and more computers. That's for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think the advances in seed technology and those things. So It'll be fun to watch.
Interesting.
We also had a listener comment when we had our discussion about rotary combines, mentioned that Gleaner was actually the first rotor that was mass produced for years and was way ahead of its time, as well as both IH and Deere. And I think that I've read that before. I think that's very true.
Oh yeah. And that story's in Snoopy. The New Holland was a year sooner, 1975, New Holland twin rotor. There was a man, named, I believe it's Bill Hill, who was an IH engineer working on the axle flow in the late 60s and early 70s. He decided that it should be a two rotor, not a one rotor system, which is what the New Holland is. And he and the chief engineer got into a spat about that, and he left, went to New Holland. 3 years later, the IH engineers are in a parking lot. They find a twin rotor combine parked, and they literally actually drove it, which is completely, you shouldn't do that, right? I mean, somebody else did. It's a New Holland twin rotor combine.
Right.
And realized that this engineer had taken the drawings with him to New Holland, and they developed the twin rotor. There was a huge lawsuit. It was settled out of court, so we don't know what happened. And of course, now the two companies are combined, so nobody cares.
But right. Nobody cares.
That is a lot of intrigue in that twin rotor combo.
Lee, have you ever written any books on Steiger or Bobcat as two tractor names that are very near and dear to this region?
My book, Red Four-Wheel Drive Tractors, has a good third of that book is Steiger. So a lot about Steiger there. Bobcat, I haven't. I have talked to those families, and we just never quite got it together. I'd love to. Bobcat's the other fascinating ag story from that region, and really one of the great ag stories, of ag equipment stories, at least of our time.
Oh, so Lee, where are people going to come and find your book, Snoopy and the Spy, and so many others? Because I think we've piqued the interest for many folks that they probably want to follow up with all the stories that you have to share.
Great. Our books are available anywhere books are sold. Quite a few of them will be at Case IH dealerships. You can check that out. But any bookstore, if they don't have them, can order them. And of course, any of the big online retailers have it. You also can go to octanepress.com and get our books. They're priced competitively there. And I'd say if somebody hasn't, if you're new to my stuff, go get Snoopy and the Spy. There's Deere, there's IH, there's other brands. It's quick, it's fun. And if you like that, there's lots more where that came from.
It's a great read. And as someone, if you grew up farming and so many of those tractor numbers, names, all of that is familiar to you. If you remember the Red Power shows that IH put on to bring these tractors forward, I think it's pretty awesome to just read through it. And like I said, it's a short read, but it's so enjoyable. So Lee, I can't say thank you enough for joining us today. When I first heard you speak at Farm Progress, I just knew you'd be full of wonderful stories.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I love talking about this stuff. So it's my pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, Lee.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. And folks, don't go anywhere. We still have some headlines. We need to check on the weather, and you can call us with your questions on the Red Wing Shoe Line, 701-339-000. We'll be back.
And welcome back to Weather and Ag and Focus, 1:53 in the afternoon. Temperatures outside in the mid-40s across the valley and in the Lakes Country, even cooler out to our west where that fog is persistent from about Jamestown up through Devil's Lake, where temperatures there are only in the 30s. And just west of that, it's in the 50s. So if you're going west on 94, you're going to start in Fargo in the 40s, drop into the 30s with the fog in Jamestown, and just west of Jamestown, you'll pop up into the 50s and into the 60s by the time you get into the western part of the state. So you've got every season within about a 4.5-5 hour drive if you're going on 94. So kind of weird weather that we've got for today. And we're going to hang with the clouds for the rest of the afternoon. And then tomorrow we'll finally see a little sunshine, highs in the low 50s. We'll stay in the 50s on Saturday with breezy conditions. And then a cold front swings through Saturday night, bringing an isolated shower or two. And then Sunday, breezy out of the north with 40s coming back. And then 50s come back on Monday. And then a good chance of widespread rain for Monday night, especially Tuesday, it looks like mainly, but Tuesday into Wednesday, widespread rain. Now, it'll probably end as some wet snow on Wednesday as temperatures fall back into the 30s, but a lot of wind, and we're looking at least right now, and again, this can change, but I like what I'm seeing in terms of consistency with the models, that widespread rain in the at least the eastern third, it might go out to the central part of the state too, of a half inch to some spots over an inch of rain. So that is fantastic news. And we need it. We need the moisture. And again, let's hope that that our models kind of hold this track in place. I'm sure it'll change a few times between now and early next week, but at least our models are pretty consistent on this for some much, much needed moisture.
Well, we look forward to seeing what it does bring, because all of it can be a positive right now.
And right. Yeah. And it looks so like the majority of this will be in the form of rain. I'm not too concerned, because the cold air doesn't get wrapped in until after the system starts to move away. So that's good news there.
I'm just so glad you were able to do the weather, because I was sort of busy on Lee's website shopping for books right now. So there's some good ones. I am very excited to go see some of these things. You know,
how many books does he have about?
Well, his website, he has several himself, but his website includes more, such as The Diesel Odyssey of Klesy Cummins, the guy who built Cummins engines. I mean, it's fascinating. Lee made mention in his book about the Farm Progress Show, which in Iowa, it covers 600 acres. This used to be held on somebody's farm. They would plan for 2 years and clean up for a year afterwards. And I'm kind of hoping there's a book that talks just about how people used to prepare to have 250,000 people tour their farm in a 3-day period.
So is this,
can you imagine?
So this is bigger than the event down in Baltic?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes. Considerably larger.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Yeah, that 3-day event, and it alternates between Iowa and Illinois. It's in Decatur, Illinois, or Boone, Iowa. Again, they're pushing 250,000 people in a 3-day run on a 600-acre spot. It's massive.
Yeah.
Massive. Like yeah. So other things that are massive, well, the U.S. poultry industry and their effect on the U.S. economy. Poultry brings to us a total of $663 billion of total impact. That's over 2 million jobs, and they pay their share, $54 billion in taxes as well. Now, that is an industry that's on the rebound, considering what we've seen with bird flu as of late, and I'm looking forward to watching their growth. They've been keeping up. Supply has been better. Our price of eggs is not quite as high as it once was, but if you do see incremental increases in the grocery store, let's face it, we are fast approaching the holiday baking season, as well as everybody who wants to start a new diet in the new year. And with heavy protein-focused diets, eggs are a cheaper source of protein, and people like to use them in a variety of ways. So we're going to probably see another spike in price, but I don't know that we'll see a tight supply on the egg situation going forward. We'll see what it looks like.
And what about blueberries? Yeah. We were going to talk about this yesterday.
Oh, we were going to talk about them yesterday. Blueberries, who do you think is the country that raises the most blueberries for the world?
South America.
Well, that's a country, but that's a continent, but a country would be
Brazil.
Peru. Peru raises the most.
Really?
And for Peru, what they are doing is using new cutting edge genetics for drought tolerance and disease tolerance to help us all around the world. Not only what they do there, but their gene editing can be used in other crops globally as well.
Interesting. Good deal. Well, that'll do it for us for Weather and Ag in Focus. We'll be back tomorrow with a special guest about a new weather model that we're using now. The Jay Thomas Show is coming up next.